Hi, it's Gavin.
And Phil.
I don't know about you, but it can sometimes feel like we're living in a bad news world. Wars, scandals, crisis after crisis.
But if you're ready to change the soundtrack and hear what God is really doing, we have a brand new podcast just for you.
We're traveling the UK, seeing people come to faith, churches grow, and new life break out.
With real stories, fresh research, and inspiring leaders, we are ready to give you a front row seat to God on the move.
Good News People is a new podcast from Premier and the Evangelical Alliance.
So listen now on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, YouTube, or wherever you get your podcasts.
We are Good News People in a bad news world.
And when somebody says to you, "Can I help you?" you say, "No, I'm fine." They want to be generous to you, and you're not letting them be. So could you please stop it?
The Profile with Premier Christianity Magazine.
Hello and welcome to The Profile here on Premier Christian Radio. I'm Sam Hales, editor of Premier Christianity Magazine. That's the UK's leading Christian magazine, and you can get a special offer right now and become a subscriber at premierchristianity.com. Here on The Profile, though, we like to sit down with a different Christian each and every week and hear something of their life story, their faith journey. And I'm really pleased to say that in studio today with me is Mike Dixon. He describes himself as the accidental co-founder of the children's charity WizKids, now the UK's leading charity for young wheelchair users. Mike helped raise £150 million to provide mobility equipment for tens of thousands of disabled young people in the UK. He's now working with Our Generous Gene to champion generosity, and he's the author of a number of books. The most recent one, though, is How to Be a Better Human. And he joins me now. Mike, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me. Thank you.
Pleasure to have you in. I'm really looking forward to hearing some more about your life and your faith journey. I'd love to start, if that's okay, with the story of WizKids, because you say that you accidentally founded WizKids. And yeah. I think this involved you signing up for the London Marathon. Do you want to tell us some of the story?
Well, it's absolutely true. I was at a drinks party before Christmas one year, and the host challenged everybody to run the... said, "Who wants to run the London Marathon?" And I stuck my hand up, and then I forgot all about it. And then shortly after Christmas, I got a fax through, which shows you how old it long ago it was, and it basically said, "This is a training schedule, and the marathon is in 12 weeks, and you have to go running." And I was a bit shocked by this. So anyway, I phoned up a friend of mine. I persuaded him to do it as well. And we started what we called training, which meant that we actually only ran a maximum of 6 miles in one time before we ever got to the start line. So it was quite an achievement, really. But the thing I learned from that, which you can probably talk about later, was that if you stick your hand up for things that you probably don't know anything about, it leads to all sorts of amazing adventures and serendipitous things happen to you, which, in fact, in my case, changed my life and changed another girl's life as well.
So how did you go from running that marathon to starting WizKids, this charity to help disabled children?
Well, we'd run the marathon to raise money for a young woman called Sammy, who was 12 and has cerebral palsy. And she had a speech impediment. She couldn't move around on her own. She was in a wheelchair being pushed around by other people. And so we ran 26.2 miles, wandered around it quietly, to raise money to provide movement, mobility for a young person who couldn't move.
Yeah.
So that was the purpose of the venture. And by the time we got to the start line, we'd actually raised about £9,000, which is a lot of money in those days.
And a lot of money now.
A lot of money now, yes. And some people even sponsored us to cross the starting line. It was that bad. And so I went and I met this young woman, in Lincoln, and was profoundly moved by talking to her and came back. So we sent a letter to all of our friends, and they provided us money. And off, anyway, we went off and we ran round, and then we went out and celebrated. And then somebody we knew who had started a charity said, you should start a charity to help disabled children who can't move. Then somebody else said, well, we'll fund the core funding of the starting of the charity. None of this was intended at all. Anyway, to cut a long story short, Ricky and Shuna and I found ourselves starting a charity 1 year after we'd run the marathon.
Right.
And, you know, it changed this young girl's life. She had this powered wheelchair. She could move around. We had $6,000 or something left over from it all. And we found ourselves the founder of a charity. Yeah. Ricky was a doctor. Shuna was in marketing. I ran a business. So we had no experience at all. We didn't really know what we were doing.
Yeah. And you went from fundraising for the London Marathon for one child to then starting this charity, which has since helped thousands of young people and children to have that mobility, which is an incredible gift for people who... you know, quite literally physically stuck and unable to get around. You've provided the finance for that to be possible. I'd love to actually go right back to the beginning, if that's okay. We like to start at the beginning with our guests and just hear a little bit about what life was like for you growing up, what your family background was like, and maybe if there were any hints in your childhood of what would come later in terms of the things that you'd be passionate and involved in your career.
Well, not really. I wasn't the brightest person at school. I didn't really understand what was going on. So when I left, it was quite difficult because in those days you had to go into banking or the services or whatever else or join an oil company or something. But I couldn't make that at all. So I did what normal people do. I became a sort of entrepreneur. I opened a store, of all places, in Portobello Road, not Portobello Road, in Petticoat Lane, and sold... jewellery and posters and this sort of thing, and it was quite successful for a while, and then I moved on to other adventures, entrepreneurial adventures, so I think what actually happened was, not being terribly successful at school, I became an entrepreneur. I did some things that were really, really clever and some things that weren't terribly clever, you know, because some of the things you do don't work, some of them do. All the way through my 20s, I really actually firmly wanted to make money, and it wasn't until I was in my late 30s and started WizKids that I realised that there were other things to life apart from making money, i.e. being in a position to help other people, and it had a profound effect on my life, really.
And tell me a bit about where faith comes into the picture. Was the Christian faith part of your upbringing, or did that come for you later?
No, it wasn't part of my upbringing, apart from the normal, you know, go to church occasionally and weddings and Christmas and so on. But the faith really came into my life, my wife's life, when my wife decided that we had to have our children christened. And so that was fair enough. They were sort of, I think, 6, 4 and 2 or something. And so we went round local churches and looked for churches that welcomed children. And we found one locally that was literally packed with little people, you know, wandering around. And also it was very welcoming. And the vicar then had worked for all, of all things, for Unilever. And then he'd become a vicar and man of faith. And he introduced us, I mean, it sounds pathetic, but he introduced us for the first time to the power of prayer and to the power of community, a Christian community. And so we started going to this church after we'd had the children christened.
Right.
So it was the christening of the children that led to, now adults obviously, that led to us beginning to discover faith.
Yeah, that's so interesting because I think so often we hear stories of people who might want to get their children christened for all sorts of reasons, and often, especially now, someone might do that and never set foot in the church again. That wasn't your experience. I'd be really interested to know, what was it that kept you coming back? Okay, you've done the christening, that's lovely, but there must have been a real sense of faith becoming real for you to bother keep going back to church each week. What was going on?
Well, I think we had to do 2 or 3 lessons before, with the vicar, before, with another couple, before he would Christmas, but he wasn't judgmental about it, he was going to do it. And we turned up, and I know it sounds ridiculous now, but he started reading from the Bible, and which is a perfectly reasonable thing to do, but Shuna was running a company, I was running a business, and we didn't read the Bible, really. And then when we got into the church, we discovered this wonderful community of people, and we saw people praying for each other and so on. And I think we were intrigued, and particularly, and very interested, and particularly one amazing woman called Jean and two or three others, of all things, asked us to go and join a home group. And again, we had no idea what that was about at all. Subsequently, we ended up running them. Mm-hmm. So we went to a home group, a weekly group. We got together to read the Bible and pray and so on. And that home group was a complete surprise, but it also kept going for most of our 30s. And so the people that we were in the home group with grew together in their work careers, and also in the growing up of their children. They all grew up together, and so we became really, really, really good friends. Mm. And I think even today, I mean, we've been leading home groups and in home groups, and I think they're a really wonderful thing to develop and come out from a church.
Mm. Yeah, absolutely. You mentioned a moment ago that in your 20s you were very entrepreneurial, starting new things, but you said as well that they didn't always work out, and that's very normal to hear that from entrepreneurs. You start a lot of things, you're trying things. Mm. Tell me what some of the lessons were from that point in your life of starting things, and perhaps if there are any lessons that came out of the failures as much as the successes.
My wife always says that every time I have an idea and decide to do something, I just do it. And that's the good news. And the bad news is, of course, that you know, whatever you start hits bumps. Doesn't matter what it is, whether it's Premier Radio or a business or a charity or something. And so the ability to keep going and sort of swerve and alter the path but not the destination is really important. And so learning from mistakes, I mean, the first one in Petticoat Lane, took an absolute fortune for the first 6 weeks selling things on this stall.
What were you selling?
Jewellery for women and posters. Mm-hmm. I always had a young woman with me as well. Until I got to the sixth week and discovered that I didn't have any money left because of cash business. Yes, right. I'd gone out every week and spent it. And the thought that I might actually have to go and buy stock had never dawned on me at all. And so I had to go and borrow some money from a Barclay card. I mean, or now a Visa card. So, and then of course you learn that if you're selling something, it has a cost, and you must have the money to go and buy some more to sell them again. But the first time I did it, I had no idea what I was doing at all. And that's a typical. I mean, that's an example of learning on the hoof, really.
Yeah. And if I'd met you when you were selling posters and women's jewellery from that market, and I'd said to you, what's the grand plan? Where do you want to go in life? You know, where do you want to be in 30 or 40 years' time? What do you think you would have said? And is the answer different now?
Oh, yes. I mean, definitely at that stage, I was absolutely determined to make money. I wanted to make, that was the purpose of the venture. For the last 30 years, it's been completely different. Mm. It's been to help as many people as possible, and I've been fortunate to be quite helpful doing that. Charities and people in trouble, and have formed huge friendships and greater numbers of people who have persuaded to do the same.
Mm. I was reading you've actually defined the purpose of life as, quote, helping other people.
Yes.
For you, that's the whole point. Just tell me how you came to that conclusion. What changed you from, I want to go and make as much money as possible and be in business, to my life's work is now about helping people?
Well, when I was actually working in WizKids and when it was growing, again, we did succession planning. So we left after 6 years or something. But when I was there, and it was great, and it was growing vertically, straight up, really, I noticed the impact that generosity had on the people who gave. Mm. And quite often people would say to me, helping this child move is probably the best thing I've done all year. Mm. These are people from banks and things. So I began to notice the impact that giving had on the people who gave, as well as the people, obviously, who received. And that develops because after I left WizKids in a managerial role, and I also resigned from the board, I managed to persuade lots of people, companies, finance people, hedge funds, private equity people, to adopt charities and help them. And that is a seriously enjoyable thing to do. I mean, providing you do it in the right way. And so I worked out plans to help companies and plans to help individuals and families, introducing them to people who are doing wonderful work and getting them to adopt them and fund them. Well, it's not a bad way to spend a day, really, to be honest.
It's amazing. I mean, I find that amazing. But how would you convince someone who says, well, I'm not in that place. Maybe they're a young person, beginning their career, and they're thinking, sounds lovely, Mike, but I just want to accumulate a lot of wealth. I want the fast cars. I want the nice house.
Yeah.
Convince me otherwise. Is life really about helping others? For me, life is about looking after my own and enjoying life's spoils.
It's perfectly acceptable to set out to make money or make a success of your career. I think the turning point comes is adding on something to your life that helps other people.
So they're not necessarily intentional opposites. You can do both. You can have a good career, but you can help other people.
Yeah, you can do both. And for example, we've worked with people who run financial institutions, hedge funds, and this sort of thing. And they all eventually arrive at a stage where, not all of them, but most of them arrive at a stage where they've done incredibly well. And actually, they do want to be useful, but they don't know how to do it.
Mm.
So it's not that you do one or the other.
Mm.
You carry on doing whatever you want to do, becoming a successful actor or a successful finance person or a successful business. But particularly if you're a successful business, you have to have another part of the business that actually looks after the people who work in the business, but also the people you work with, your suppliers, your communities, and so forth.
Mm.
It makes a healthy company.
I'm by no means an expert on the idea, but I've heard of this idea of what's called corporate social responsibility.
Mm.
Talk to me more about that. This idea that you can be a very successful bank or business, but there's perhaps more of an understanding now than there was that with that power comes responsibility, and it's a good thing to give back. Has that been part of what you've been doing in recent years, helping people to make that connection?
I mean, years ago, they called it corporate social responsibility, and it was all a bit of a sort of fig leaf,
something
a company did, we've done this. But then it became, and is now, absolutely critical to the success of a thriving business, because people have always wanted to, but they particularly now want to work for a business that is successful with, no matter what the business is successful with people that are great and also have a purpose and a profit motive.
Mm.
And that's what keeps them there. Mm. And that's what stops them going off to other businesses and this and other. It's very, and because they love doing it.
I want to talk about some of the other things you've been involved in the time we have. Tell me about Rainmakers.
Rainmakers, well, it was a first attempt to get a community of people together who would merge their talents together to help other people. And it was really good, and it worked quite well. And at one stage, for example, we managed to persuade Desmond Tutu to become the patron of it. And I learned a lot from him, and so did we all, really, particularly about the subject of forgiveness, obviously. Raising the money every year to keep the whole thing going wore me out in the end, and we did succession planning with that again, and two very capable people took it on, but after a while it didn't keep going. So I think after about 2 years after I left or did succession planning, they decided to fold it as well. So it was successful in one way because I was learning about how to make people useful and encouraging people to be useful, but because it had a financial overhead and had to raise money for itself every year, it wasn't really sustainable.
Mm. I think I'd love to hear a bit more about Desmond Tutu, who just mentioned, who was a patron of this organisation that you were running. What specifically did you learn from him? I mean, did you have the chance to sort of speak to him in private and hear his stories, and what's your memories of that time?
Well, yes and yes, really. I mean, the first thing is that unbelievably, really. Ricky, who's the guy I ran the first marathon with, one day over dinner, about 10 years after we'd started with his kids, owned up to the fact that he was Desmond Tutu's godson.
Wow.
Never told me at all. And so the Arch, as we got to know him, the Archbishop Desmond Tutu, I asked him if he would come and help Rainmaker and talk to people about generosity and so on. And I went out to South Africa to meet him, had dinner with him, that sort of thing. One of the things I noticed about him was that in the restaurant where we were, and I was sort of sitting next to him, he knew the names of all the waiters, all the staff, all about their families. You know, he wasn't remotely affected by anybody he was sitting with. He knew everybody. And he'd say to them, you know, hello, how are you? And how's your sorter? And so on. And then he came to London to speak to 100 of our friends about the power of generosity. And, of course, he, on a practical note, he had a wonderful sense of humour. He and the Dalai Lama took the mickey out of each other regularly and about each other's faiths, you know, Buddhism. And you know, they were great friends. Yeah, he spoke to them all about the power of generosity, but also about the power of forgiveness. So he told me some stories about he was the chair of the Truth and Reconciliation Council in South Africa. So he brought those two opposing sides together, which was unbelievable, really. I mean, you know, people who had completely different opposing views of life. And he also had personal experience of forgiveness in his own life. And he was just a wonderful, wonderful man. And it was a privilege, actually, to know him. And when he came to talk to us all in London, he made everybody laugh. He took the mickey out of me, which is a normal behaviour of most people. And we got on really well. But then, of course, sadly, he died. He had prostate cancer for a long time and then eventually passed. And I think, you know, everybody who met him, and obviously there are thousands and thousands of people, feel deeply blessed that they ever knew him, and we all learned something from him.
Mm. Yeah, absolutely. What's been the best day of your career and what's been the worst?
Oh, good Lord. But the best days keep on happening, I'm afraid, and literally every day.
That's good to hear.
The worst days, I mean, I suppose when something fails, things are bad news, you know.
So it doesn't get easier over time?
No, it doesn't really get easier. When something is wonderfully successful, you know, everybody thinks you're wonderful, and when something goes down the drain, you have to pull yourself together and regroup. So I think that's...
Do you learn who your friends are? I mean, you mentioned when things go well, everyone sort of wants to be your friend, everyone's praising you. And presumably when things go badly, are there some people who just sort of disappear into the shadows and other people who are a bit more loyal than that and actually with you through thick and thin?
Well, I think that's very normal. But, you know, now, and we'll come to this later, one of the most important things that we can do, or anybody else can do, including everybody listening to this, and we'll come to it probably later, is that when people do run into trouble, for whatever it is, it's really important to come alongside them, to think about how they are and call them and be in touch with them and go for walks with them and so on. So actually, it's something that I've learned and it's something that everybody that we know now does.
Mm. Just before we came on air, we were mentioning that you... you gave a TED talk, a TEDx talk, and the subject of that talk was What is Enough? And I'd love to know what made you choose that subject, and I guess what your conclusion is as well, because it's quite a profound question when you think about it. What is enough? I think especially for us in the West, where most of us are quite used to being pretty affluent by the rest of the world's standards. You know, what is enough? What was your conclusion?
It's different for everybody. For myself and indeed my amazing wife, we met a man called Charles Handy, who's since sadly passed on, and his wife, Elizabeth. And they came to our house one day and they described how they lived. And he was a well-known author and wrote books about change and management. They came to our house one day and I was writing a book about giving and he was writing a book about philanthropy. and his wife was taking pictures of the philanthropists. So we had that in common, and he described to us how he lived his life, and basically every year in the autumn they worked out how much money they needed to earn the following year to pay for, you know, school fees and mortgages and everything else. Then he added 10% because he worries about everything, and then they set off to earn that amount of money, and again, not that they could get by on, but there was what they wanted to earn. And then they divided the year into three. One third of the year they worked to earn. He really gave management talks and so on. And one third of the year they did something they wanted to do that interested them, say wrote a book about something. And one third of the year they ran around doing pro bono work, helping people for nothing. So if he was asked to go and give a talk somewhere, you know, maybe India, he'd say, I'll come and I'll do it for nothing, providing my wife can come too, you find somewhere for us to stay. And really interestingly, you, the host, introduce us to the 10 most interesting people you know in, say, Delhi.
Wow.
That was it. So he'd do it for nothing, but so that he could learn. So we decided to do the same. And it's what Charles called maximizing your life, not your income. In other words, if you know that you can earn the amount that you need to live, you have to be able to do that. Then you can turn your attention to doing other things that interest you, meeting all sorts of other people, and also to helping other people.
Mm.
Now you can't do that when you're building a business necessarily, or you've got a job that actually is useful, like being a doctor or a nurse or a teacher or a taxi driver or anybody. So, but that was where we started off, and that's what we did really for about the next 25 years.
Hi, it's Sam Hales, editor of Premier Christianity magazine. I'm proud to say we are celebrating our 60th anniversary. From our beginnings as Buzz in the 1960s to the vibrant multi-platform magazine we are today, our commitment to connecting faith with the world around us has never changed. To mark the occasion, we have a special offer of 12 months for half price. That's just £24 for print and digital access. Subscribe today at premierchristianity.com. Automatically renews at £47.99.
I was going to ask you, you know, because you do so much speaking, writing on generosity, I was going to ask you sort of what that looks like in your own life. Maybe that's part of the answer. So you're giving a third of your year to pro bono work, to, you know, helping other people. And I guess this changes over time, as you mentioned, what stage of life you're at. I mean, the example you give of a third, a third, a third, I mean, that might only apply to a very small
number
of people. Yeah. But what other ways are you practicing generosity in your life which you think others could learn from or emulate aside from that?
Well, we learned again. So at the end of 2019, we decided to get, we wrote an email to 20 friends saying, would they like to form a group to help each other and help other people? And by the end of the week, they'd all agreed. And so we formed another group, but with no overhead and so on. And it met and still does meet regularly. And then they all recommended friends for them to join. And so it grew. But it's informal and it's sort of very personal. And it's all based on trust. But otherwise, you know, everybody that we met, we're very fortunate. We met lots of people who had money and had resources or ran companies. And we ran around helping them become useful. And once you get into it, it's quite... Well, it's an absolute blessing to be able to do.
Mm.
And then, obviously, in the church as well. You know, we grew in our faith, we grew in the church. I tithe, blah, blah, blah. And so we've been able to be useful in a church community. And a church community is an amazing thing. Probably another subject for another question, but... a church community is probably the strongest part of it, is being a community.
Mm.
Obviously, in faith, but you know, being a community.
Yeah, I wanted to get your views on that. I mean, how optimistic, how positive are you about the church and Christians when it comes to generosity? Do you feel like this is a subject that Christians excel at in giving in lots of different ways, or do you think actually there's things to learn that maybe Christians haven't totally grasped? I mean, we do follow a saviour who said it's better to give than to receive. So you'd hope that this is not completely new news to most Christians.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I remember the first person who, in my sort of learning curve, the first person who ever persuaded me to give a regular donation to the upkeep of my church was somebody that I actually knew was completely and utterly broke. Wow. The young man, completely and utterly broke, and I knew he was broke because I knew them all. I was on the prayer ministry team and so on. And he got up one day and he said that he gave money every month to the church. And I thought, good Lord. I sort of associated it with somebody who had an income. I mean, not unreasonably. And anyway, he was the man who persuaded me to give regularly to the church. And so then I started learning about that. And as you know, I mean, well, I'm not sure whether you do know, but either way, giving of any sort is best really done quietly. Mm. And giving money is done even more quietly. Mm. So, and then I noticed other people in the church were giving. And I also got to know that they all had problems too. They were looking for jobs or whatever, they had major problems, but they still had the faith and they still gave to their church. And I think, generally speaking, the churches I've been to, that is the case. I think Christians generally are generous, I mean, as a statement, provided it's explained why they should be generous, and most of them then catch it.
Mm. Yeah. Absolutely. I mean, I can't help but reflect. We're sitting in Premier's brand new studios here in central London with some lovely camera equipment and microphones and screens. And this is only possible because of the generous supporters of Premier who believe in our mission to help people encounter God through media. And I think you're right. In my experience as well of church and Christian ministry, Christians in this country and elsewhere are incredibly generous people. You've written and talked so much about generosity. I'd love to know who you have in mind when you're doing that. You know, perhaps if you're saying, well, Christians already are pretty generous, do you feel like a lot of your work has been to perhaps those who are particularly wealthy or in business or financed, where you feel like maybe this message hasn't been heard to the same extent as it has in the church about being generous?
I think it's always... you can't really stop, but to be truthful, it's more everyday life. I mean, the things that please almost anybody, it's not the money given away, it's the time given away. And I think that, and I think about the most powerful moments that I've had in giving away. I mean, one happened last week, a woman I know very well sent me a picture of her son looking overjoyed because he had just discovered that her friend, me, had been the founder of WizKids. So she sent me this thing. And then we swapped WhatsApps and so on. And then it turned out that he had put WizKids up as the charity for his school. And so, and one thing led to another. And now I'm going to go to the school and talk to 200 young primary school children about generosity. Wow. So it's another example of serendipity. I mean, fortunately I run my own calendar, but it's and then on another level, you know, I landed up at a church away day about two years ago, and the vicar, who's a really great bloke, said to me, come here. And I went to him and he said, could you go and pray over there, join the prayer team. So I went there and I came across this lovely man, very tall man, who didn't speak English at all. He was Iranian. Mm. And so there I was. And then this woman arrived and she was Iranian and she's translated. So when I prayed for him, and back. Anyway, this was going on amongst a big prayer ministry session, and I could clearly see things were going on to the point where everybody else had finished praying and we were still going at it. And he was an Iranian refugee, just come to this country, wife and child, you know, left behind. And anyway, it's kind of all sort of, we see him now. He'd been to dinner. Yeah, he and his family have been to dinner, his family girl here. He's absolutely lovely. Glorious, he speaks English now, and he's got a job and all that. And so it's a simple things that you can do that help people, and you can do it every day without drama or... Yeah. And you're probably, I mean, I don't know whether you've read the bit about Simon Sinek. He's a well-known writer, management guru in America, wonderful following. And he was being interviewed by Steve Bartlett about his life. And he was talking about how he'd been very successful in his life. He had ADHD, so he couldn't always register emotions with people. But whenever something went wrong, people kept on coming up to him and saying, you know, you're really, really talented. You're going to be all right. It's all going to be fine. You'll get over this and you'll recover and it'll all be all right again. And he said, you know, I really don't need this sort of thing. I know I'm going to be all right. I'm just having a hard time. I know it's going to be tough, but I am going to be all right. And all I want people to do is keep in touch with me, and then this wonderful, wonderful expression, sit in the mud with me. Mm. In other words, he didn't want people to be wise and clever, and he just wanted people to be with him, travel alongside him. And honestly, in my experience of helping lots and lots of people, I find that to be true. Mm. You know, people just want people to be with them. They don't necessarily want people's views.
Yeah. Yeah, so true. There's so much need in the UK, in the world. How do you choose what causes to back or to give to or to where to put your time?
Well, the causes is relatively straightforward. It's causes that, I mean, whether it's indigenous tribes in the Amazon or charities on housing estates in Liverpool or whatever, that's really... It's basically the leadership of the NGO. So it's somebody who wants passionately to do something about it and is committed to doing it, whatever the subject is, whether it's domestic abuse or poverty or villages, bringing education to villages in Africa or India. It's the people who are the founders who... are determined to do it. Mm. And a friend of that is they need to be able to listen, obviously. You know, it's not, you can't grow anything without being reasonably sensible about it. Mm. My own time and my wife's time, we basically help people permanently below the radar. Mm. And to be honest, there's not really an excuse for not doing it unless they don't listen. And often you can ask people, put this in the book as well, you can say, can I help you? You know, would you like some help? And they go, oh no, I'm fine, really, I'm fine. In other words, they don't put their hand up at all, back to the earlier thing. And they don't put their hand up at all. And so, you know, sometimes you have to go out of your way to encourage them to put their hand up and say, no, what sort of help do you need?
It's very interesting. But what is that? Is that just pride? Not wanting to ask for help?
Oh, no, good Lord, no. When I was in another life, I had some people working for me, and they used to say to me, some very clever people, and they used to say to me, every time we say to you, what can we do to help you? You'd say, no, I'm fine. And then literally they took me out for coffee, and they said, do you realise you're being a pain? The people working... with me and for me.
Yeah.
And I said, why? And they said, well, you know, you're writing about generosity and you're wandering around making people useful and all the rest of it. And when somebody says to you, can I help you? You say, no, I'm fine. And that's just not good enough. They want to be generous to you. You're preaching about generosity or talking about generosity. They want to be generous to you and you're not letting them be.
Mm.
So could you please stop it? It was really impressive behaviour. These were people I worked with, you know, like, and so I learned practically from that, because I went around saying, no, really, really, really all right. Right. And I got told off.
Yeah, that's really interesting. I've heard that said before, that, you know, again, Jesus said it's more blessed to give than to receive. And so if someone is wanting to give to me and I'm saying, oh, no, I'm fine, in a sense, I'm preventing that person from receiving a blessing.
That's right.
Which is a very interesting way of looking at it, which I think certainly I've not always seen it that way. But there's some truth in that we have to be willing to receive the generosity of others.
And it is terribly common. I mean, really, unbelievably common. I mean, people find it really hard to ask for help. Yeah. Mm.
So let's talk about the new book, How to Be a Better Human, which is a great title. There you go. You've got a copy there in front of you.
Yeah.
Tell me a bit about this book and how it came about.
Well, I decided to write a very short book to encourage people to look after each other. It had to be short because people would read it in under an hour. And so I sat down and I wrote the first draft, which was only 11,000 words, and I sent it to 12 very good friends, but, you know, not fans, good friends, and I asked them what they thought of it, and they all said they thought it was a really good idea, and they all critically improved it. Hmm. They all gave me suggestions that were really good and to make it better. So the second draft was 15,000 words. And it included things like, you know, you should give more stories, you should do this, you should do that. And then I started talking to publishers about it, and then they said, well, you know, you need to add in a bit about you, because people will read this and say, well, who is this man wandering around giving us all this advice and wisdom and so on? So it went through all those morphs until it came out, and people have just been unbelievably positive about it. But they reviewed it all while I was doing it, and every single person made it better.
Wow.
It was wonderful, really, really wonderful.
Mm. It's a bold title, How to Be a Better Human.
Mm.
Are there tips in there that you feel like people can take on and use immediately? Is it quite practical?
Oh, yeah. There's an entire appendix of things to do to be useful. I mean, I've got one wonderful, wonderful, just looking at it, wonderful Irishman. Sorry, I'm fumbling around looking for things. But this one person said, if you only do one thing today, show up and let someone know they're loved. And then there's all sorts of other things. There's a wonderful diagram in here, which is a picture. It's a round picture, and it says someone's life, and the whole thing is filled in, and there's a little arrow saying what you know about it, and it's tiny. So, and then it goes on to right the way through to basically to tell everybody to think about their three best friends, their three best friends, and how they might be. And when you ask people about their three best friends and how they are, they'll always tell you there's something, they're facing some challenge or other. Mm-hmm. And then I say to them, well, if they're your three best friends, then everybody else in the room's like that. Mm-hmm. So, or everybody else in the church is like that. Mm-hmm. So your mission is to come alongside and find out how they are.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the first thing. The second thing is, in the prevailing current climate of doom and gloom and everything's going wrong, there are literally millions of people all over the world changing the world for the better, doing wonderful things. And one of the most picked up stories, which I'm sure you've heard, is the story of the starfish. Have you heard the story of the starfish? Anyway, it's a story, but there's a man wandering along a beach, and he sees a little girl in the distance picking up starfish and throwing them into the sea. And he goes up to the little girl and he says, what are you doing, little girl? And she says, I'm throwing starfish back into the sea. And he looks along the beach, and there are literally thousands of them. And so he says to her, well, that's really good, but I mean, there are an awful lot of starfish here. Do you really think you're going to make a difference? And so she bends down and she picks up a starfish and she throws it back into the sea, and she looks at him and says, well, it made a difference to that one. And that's what everybody can do. Mm. So over and above looking after their own friends and their family and their community and so on, they can get out and make a difference to someone helping people get themselves fed or go to school in India, or help people in Liverpool, or help people in anywhere, really. They can go and help one or two or three or more. Everybody can do it. You can do it. I'm sure you do.
Well, it raises all sorts of questions, doesn't it, of how much each person can do. And I love that story of the starfish, of throwing it back in. And I'm sure there's a famous Mother Teresa quote which is similar, about just helping the one person in front of you, and that being enough. And I do wonder if sometimes we are a bit overwhelmed, as you mentioned, the negative news. It can be a bit paralysing, can't it, if you only read headlines of everything going wrong. You forget that actually there's another side to the story, that all of us can make an incredible impact. I mean, especially today with technology and the number of different people and charities that are doing good in the world, especially as Christians, we don't lack churches or Christian charities to support, who are making a real difference. But clearly you feel like there needs to be more of that positivity, that actually things can change for the better.
Well, I mean, on behalf of me and almost everyone I know, everybody's overwhelmed by the daily grief and news, and coming in from, it doesn't really matter whether it's politics or wars or poverty or whatever, it's just constant. It's incredibly depressing, and I think a lot of people do turn off from it altogether, because the sheer volume of it. I mean, every day, whether it's the number of wars going on, and the victims of those wars, or whether it's politics. I mean, people losing faith in politicians, not all of them, but some of them, or people getting really depressed about the climate. I mean, you get depressed about everything, really, and it's relentless. And I think being able to point out to people that individually they can do something in their own community, and indeed help people who are trying to change the world themselves, is basically a jolly good cure from it all.
Help us think about that practically. So you say we can all do something. I mean, aside from, I don't know, giving to a local church, Christian charity, like what practically do you have in mind when you say anyone can make a difference? What sort of things do you think people maybe aren't doing that they could do?
Well, I mean, back to the beginning, I mean, one of the best things you can do is support the people who are doing the work. I mean, as in with either mentally or physically or managerially, or people who have got managerial talents or whatever can help an organization grow. People got communication skills can help an organization grow. As things grow, they need different sorts of skills. So you can use your management skills, you can use your skills for compassion. If you think, I mean, I can't remember, but the number of, I think something like half the population of the UK, I'm talking about like 26, 30 million people, volunteer in one way to help a cause. And it's not just money. I mean, there are enormous quantities of people supporting Parkinson's charities, cancer charities, charities helping all sorts of people. So you can help them in all sorts of ways by using your mind and your time. You just have to do it. And it's not all, it isn't really, it really isn't all about money. It's about getting a grip.
And what do you want to be known for when all is said and done?
Good Lord, I haven't even thought about it. I don't. I think my my wife came up years ago with this thing about, you know, being surprised by life. I think being constantly curious is good news. But I think basically I'm helping other people quietly. I mean, it's the first time I've ever thought about it, so.
It's a great answer. Well, Mike Dixon, it's been an absolute pleasure to hear something of your story and get your wisdom. Thank you so much for coming in today.
Thank you very much for having me.
You've been listening to The Profile in association with Premier Christianity Magazine.
Hi, it's Gavin.
And Phil.
I don't know about you, but it can sometimes feel like we're living in a bad news world. Wars, scandals, crisis after crisis.
But if you're ready to change the soundtrack and hear what God is really doing, we have a brand new podcast just for you.
We're traveling the UK, seeing people come to faith, churches grow, and new life break out.
With real stories, fresh research, and inspiring leaders, we are ready to give you a front row seat to God on the move.
Good News People is a new podcast from Premier and the Evangelical Alliance.
So listen now on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, YouTube, or wherever you get your podcasts.
We are Good News People in a bad news world.